Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The debate about global warming has been developing over quite a span of time. Slowly, public opinion about its validity has been moving forward with the speed of a creeping glacier. But glacial change has a whole new meaning. And we talk to the world's top glaciologists about their mysteries, their past and their future, and what that will mean to you when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News. Almost everyone knows what tree ring dating is. If you take a tree, slice right through it, you'll see each year's growth caught as a ring. Year after year, the layers build, and with it a powerful record of good seasons, bad seasons, droughts, and fires. Some of our oldest trees hold thousands of years of history in their cross-cut sections. Well, glaciers have been collecting a similar record in their annual collection and storage of ancient storms, holding deep keys to our ancient atmospheres right on through to the present. We now turn our attention to one of the world's leading paleoclimatologists and glaciologists, Dr. Lonnie Thompson, senior research scientist with the Byrd Polar Research Center, who will be joining with many other presenters this weekend in Salt Lake City at the 11th Wallace Stegner Symposium, this year focused on climate change. Selected by Time Magazine and CNN as one of America's best in science and medicine, his research has been featured in hundreds of publications, including National Geographic and the National Geographic Adventures magazines. This upcoming weekend at the Wallace Stegner Center, they're having their 11th annual symposium on global climate change, the Arctic to the Rocky Mountain West, and they have brought together for this event some of the leading scientists, researchers, and other people involved in both the science and politics of this issue that is becoming more and more talked about. It's been talked about for a long time within the science communities, and it's now reaching into the media a lot because of the sensational weather things that have been happening, particularly this last year. So people are beginning to become more aware that maybe there is something to this climate debate. So joining us now to take this another step is Dr. Lonnie Thompson, who's with the Byrd Polar Research Center at Columbus in Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Thompson, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney.
You have a rather interesting career. You are a glaciologist. First of all, just give people an idea of what it means to be a glaciologist.
Well, a glaciologist is a specialty under geology, and We study the glaciers of the world and the dynamics of those glaciers, how they move, how they record the climate and environmental history in their stratigraphy. And my life's work has been particularly aimed at getting that climate history as it's frozen in these archives.
In many respects, what you're trying to do is similar to what people who study tree rings do, and that is each year there is a cycle, a seasonal cycle, that is recorded in that layer of glaciation, and that if a person can go back, you can go back through time and make a very, very distinct analysis and really see what has been going on back in history, and that's what you've been doing for a very long time.
That's correct. And these ice cores and these glaciers, the beauty of them is that, first of all, they're not alive. They're a physical entity in the world, and therefore there's no chance of evolving or changing with time. The other thing is that some of these records actually extend back over several hundred thousands of years, so you can get this really long-term perspective of change. You know, anything that's in the atmosphere, be it the temperature as recorded in the precipitation, the snowfall on these glaciers, or the layer thicknesses tell us, you know, what the precipitation has actually been in the past. But anything in the atmosphere, from volcanic activity, either the tephra or the sulfates, pollen coming from vegetation that lives in the region below the glacier. Any type of gases that are archived in the bubbles in the ice, you know, the fact that, you know, they provide us our only time perspective of a lot of the greenhouse gases that we're concerned about, like CO2 and methane, nitrous oxide. So they record not only the climate and the environmental changes of the past, but also many of the important climate forcings that we need to understand the natural variability of in order to understand what's going on at the beginning of the 21st century.
One of the unique aspects about your research is the fact that you can travel all around the world and record really very local, relatively localized events and situations, conditions, based on where you're doing your research. Talk about some of the places that you've traveled to dig into the ice, particularly in glaciers and other places, to uncover this record.
Okay, we have records that span not only Antarctica and Greenland, which is where I actually started my career, but to these very high mountain regions down through the Andes of South America, Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, over to Africa, to Kilimanjaro, the highest mountain in Africa, in the ice fields there in Tanzania, to over to Tibet, across the Tibetan Plateau, and through the Himalayas. And so we have been able to really fill in a lot of missing areas for the world. I mean, when you think about our planet, we have 50% of the planet surface area between 30 north and 30 south, that is, in the tropics. And if we look at today's world, we have 6.5 billion people living on the planet. 70% of them live in the tropics. So it was an area that was underrepresented when we look at our what we know about the climate of the Earth, but it's an obvious place where we need to understand both the natural variability of climate, things like El Niños and monsoon variability, which are tropical phenomena, but phenomena that have tremendous impacts on crop production, the social and economic well-being of a large part of the population on our planet. So we've been able to look at these individual sites, and then more recently, what our big effort has been to try and take these regional, local climates and then weld them together so that we can look at the larger global scale changes in climate and forcings using this ice core archive.
Would you say that we have a relatively contiguous history going back in time?
But the beauty of these records is that, you know, one of the big issues is, you know, looking at when did ice start to grow on the planet? I mean, the current glaciers, because that's very important in understanding the significance of the loss of those glaciers in today's world. And we find, in fact, that if you go back in time, that depending on what latitude or longitude that you are on the planet, the time at which that ice started to grow is quite different than what you find at the higher latitudes where we have the big ice sheets. You know, understanding the natural climate processes on the planet is one of the key of getting these very high-resolution records from these different latitudes and different parts of our planet.
In a brief summary, what we have is a very accurate record going back in time that really records these various atmospheric changes that you've been able to analyze and come up with some very precise definitions of what's been going on. Let's talk in terms of this history, because so much of the debate, for example, about global warming or climate change is whether or not this is just an isolated a momentary aberration, perhaps a change in perhaps a 10-year, 20-year cycle, or if this is indicative of some larger trend. Because if it is a larger trend, that has other consequences. Well, based on your research, going back through time and making comparisons to the current research that you've been able to pull out of these ice cores at the top, what are you finding?
Well, I think there are actually several disturbing parts about that, the records. First of all, if you look at a composite of records from coming out of isotopes of our temperature proxies, the isotopes of oxygen and hydrogen that make up the ice. Whether you look at the proxy for the last 2,000 years out of the Tibetan Plateau region or from the Andes of South America, what you really see in that 2,000-year perspective is how unusual the last 50 years have been through enrichment of the isotopes and warming taking place. And when you look at those records, I mean, you can see the medieval warm period in Europe where we know temperatures were warmer in the past, and then as you come forward in time, the last neoglacial, the little ice age that begins around 1400, continues up to about 1900, where glaciers expanded in Europe and North America over in the Himalayas. And then you come into the 20th century, and there you see this this enrichment of the isotopes to the maximum level just in the last 10 years. And it's a very uniform signal. And why we believe that is critical is that if you look at the temperatures of the Earth, you know, if you're in temperate areas or the high latitudes, there's a lot of variability of temperature from day to day to season. But when you go to the tropics and you go up to the mid-troposphere where these high-elevation mountain glaciers are located, what you see is a very uniform temperature for the planet. And you can look at events like El Niños, when we get this warm water off the coast of South America. Now, within a few months, that heat has moved up into the mid-troposphere and is equally distributed around the tropics of the Earth. And so here we have this enrichment taking place in the ice core records, which says it's unusual in the perspective of 2,000 years. And at the same time, every tropical glacier on Earth is retreating, and where we have time-lapse data, the rates of retreat are actually accelerating as we come up to the present. So I think those changes in that part of the world are very significant in telling us that, you know, we do have these large changes underway.
In terms of the effect, we'll talk specifically about glaciers because you hold a rather unique record of being one person who has spent more time above 18,000 feet than most anybody can remember, actually over close to going on 2 years. That's a lot of time in the high country. That's quite a challenge. You're actually witnessing what's happening to these glaciers. So one side is the effects that this will have for our oceans, for our cultures and societies. But let's just talk about the glaciers themselves. Are you seeing literally a diminution of the glaciers or an increase in melting? What are your observations?
Well, the observations is and I'll just give you a couple examples.
Sure.
Because they are representative of everything we see going on in throughout the tropical areas on Earth. But if you go to the Andes of Peru, the Quelccaya ice cap there is the largest tropical ice cap on Earth, and we have been studying that ice cap since 1974. And you have to remember, if you go back in history and you say, okay, we didn't go to Quelccaya to study global warming. If you go back to the 70s, this wasn't even an issue. We went there to try and find a connection between that would link our records out of Antarctica to our records from Greenland through the tropics. And Quelccaya, being the largest tropical ice cap on Earth, was a good place to look. But as we developed our drilling technologies and our ability to recover those cores, we also set up monitoring stations to actually map, photograph and map the largest outlet glacier coming off of that ice cap. And with the collection of those photographs through time, we could demonstrate that, you know, not only is this ice cap retreating, but there's an exponential increase in the rate at which it's retreating as we come forward in time up to 2005. And just to put some numbers on that, in the first period of measurement, this Coriolis Glacier, the largest outlet glacier, was retreating at about 4.7 meters per year. And that's now up over over 200 meters per year.
That's phenomenal.
So it's a huge acceleration in the rate at which that ice is being lost. If you go to Kilimanjaro, and we just returned from Kilimanjaro 3 weeks ago. We first went to that mountain in 1999, and in 2000, as part of our drilling campaign there to recover the history from those cores, we had aerial photographs flown so we could make a map of the ice on the mountain in 2000. And then we took that map and compared the area of ice back through all the maps that had been made going back to 1912. In 1912, there had been 12.1 square kilometers of ice on the mountain, and by 2000, there were something less than 2.6 square kilometers. So it had lost over 80% of its ice mass in that time period. Well, we just got back 3 weeks ago, and we had the mountain reflown using the same company, the same airplane, same pilot, same photographer, the same flight plan, and you can just see the loss of ice that has occurred in the 6 years since we've been there. And so if you project, look at all the maps, and you project this in the forward into the future, sometime before 2020, the ice fields on Kilimanjaro will disappear. And if you're a glaciologist, one of our concerns is that you've lost the history that's recorded in the ice of our past climate and environmental variation with the loss of those ice fields. So even our ability to use this archive to understand the past climate variability is at risk. So one of the things we have done here as we drill these cores is to keep an archive. We now have 7,000 meters of core stored at minus 30 degrees C here at the Ohio State University that we believe that within as little as 15 years, if anyone wants to see a sample of ice from places like Kilimanjaro, they will have to come here to this archive. And we know as we go forward in time, our science will improve, our understanding will improve, but these archives aren't going to be out there for future collection. So we're trying to preserve some of that for the future.
Well, that's an extraordinarily valuable, actually invaluable record at this point, and I hope that you never experience any kind of a power failure of significance.
Well, we put a lot of thought in the backup units and the way to keep this. I'm more concerned about, the future support of science in the country to maintain these facilities.
But, well, the grand collections are under threat in various sectors right now. I'll let you summarize, but in terms of what I hear you saying, and I'll have you confirm it, is really what I'm trying to say, is that generally there seems to be an accelerating trend of the melting of glaciers fairly much globally. Am I correct about that?
Yes, it's the scale at which the change is taking place, and it doesn't matter whether you're in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere or the tropics, we're getting the same picture. And the other thing that these glaciers, they're Ernest Shackleton, he once said, what the ice gets, the ice keeps.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about, of course, his ship, the Endurance, which led to that epic journey out of Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true about these glaciers. And one of the things that, to me, is very telling and disturbing is that as these glaciers like the Kalkaya Ice Cap retreat, we have been finding, and we found the first collection in 2002, wetland plants, perfectly preserved wetland plants, in growth position, being exposed as these ice walls retreat.
Mm.
And the beauty of the plants, of course, is that they tell us we can carbon date them, and they tell us that the last time this ice field was as small as it is today. And some of these plants that we collected this past season along the margins of Kilkaya date 6,500 years in age. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, I believe that we are actually going to be able to document and say, you know, these glaciers are smaller now than they have been in X number of thousands of years as this retreat continues and this type of material becomes uncovered and can be actually sampled and dated.
Well, then, of course, the next question becomes, are you prepared to suggest that this is indicative of some overall climate change?
Oh, I think there is absolutely no doubt that the Earth is getting warmer and that that humans are playing a role in that change. And in fact, I think that it's also very clear that, you know, if you talk with people like Jim Hansen, we've already built in, even if we started to take corrective actions tomorrow, we've got at least a 1 degree Fahrenheit temperature rise built in to the system because there's a lag in it, which means that, you know, the ice fields on Kilimanjaro are going to disappear. And part of our program this year was not only to, you know, document the loss of the ice, but to try to actually assess how much of the water currently being consumed through the wells and the springs at the base of this mountain has originated from the glaciers on the summit, because there will be a human impact throughout the glaciated mountain regions of the world with the loss of this frozen archive. Because glaciers are really just nature's natural water towers or dams. They collect the water during the wet season or during rainy periods, and during droughts and dry seasons, they discharge that water. So they kind of maintain water flow that originates in these high mountain ranges of the world. And many of our major rivers have their source from these glaciers. As they diminish in size, you get more variability in the streams, and that impacts ability to produce hydroelectric power, ability for having water for irrigation, ability to have water for municipal water supplies. So I think that we have already built into our future the need for adaptation as these glaciers become smaller and in many cases actually disappear.
I'm in California, where we get a lot of our water from the high mountains, and there was a wonderful discussion recently about the fact that we need to really start to rethink this water supply, because if, for example, there is an increase in springtime temperatures where it's warming up earlier, this is going to potentially radically change the timing and the sequence of that water availability through time, and we're just going to have to figure out what that means.
Exactly. I mean, having just coming from Tanzania, while I was there, they actually started rationing power because it's produced by hydroelectric power, if the rainy season doesn't come in March, there's going to be mass starvation in that sector of the world. These changes, to me, the glaciers, and you know, particularly the glaciers in the tropics, they're kind of. I grew up in West Virginia and heard all the stories of the canaries the miners used to take down, and you know, when the canary died, it was time to get out of the mine. And to me, these tropical glaciers, they're really are sensors of change taking place, and they're telling us that the climate system is changing.
There's debate about whether or not global warming exists, but there's also debate within the community itself of people who agree that it is in existence, and that is the degree to which these changes may start to accelerate and what may be the result of those changes.
I think that there are a lot of tipping points in the world, and particularly in physical systems. And when I think about glaciers, glaciers are threshold systems. And if I look at what's going on the top of Kilimanjaro, the temperatures up there probably for the last 100 years have been below freezing, somewhere minus 2 to minus 12. But in the last 6 years, when we work with a group up at University of Massachusetts, actually has a satellite link weather station on the northern ice field. So we have hourly temperatures coming up to right now. If you look at that, you see that in the last few years there have been periods where the temperatures have actually risen above freezing on the top of the mountain. And what that means to the ice is that in 2003, there's a documented series of photographs of a lake bursting out of the side of the Furtwängler Glacier and flowing across where all the tourists come up to this mountain. And that's the first time water has been observed flowing like that on the summit crater of this mountain. And it's significant because ice, if it's below freezing, the only way you can lose the mass is through sublimation, which is going directly from a solid to a gas. And that takes 7.5 times more energy than it does to melt the ice. So once you get the water phase, you change the albedo of the ice body because this water will collect, more radiation is absorbed, and you get into these positive feedback loops so that the rate at which the ice can be lost accelerates.
I know that certainly is the case in the Arctic regions where, for example, the ice cap has served as a wonderful reflector of solar energy, and now as the ice cap is retreating, you're getting larger and larger open areas of water, which just generally is warmer. And therefore, as you say, it's this positive feedback loop.
Yeah, it absorbs more energy. It's darker color. You know, a lot of the natural processes, you know, glaciers, and to me, they're part of our balancing temperature system for the planet. You know, if it gets warm, a lot of energy in the last 100 years has actually gone into melting ice. But those ice bodies continue to get smaller and smaller. And then you expose more land surface, which absorbs more energy. So, yeah, these positive feedback loops that exist in our climate system, you know, could take us across some tipping point for the climate system.
You've worked a lot in the Arctic and the northern regions, and there's a lot of talk about that right now, specifically about Greenland. Give us your thoughts about what's happening there, because there's talk about how the evidence of a terrific, actually a doubling of the melt rate is becoming fairly evident.
Yes, and I think to me, when I look into the future, it's the things we don't expect. Scientists, by and large, just by our training, we're conservative people. And we try to understate rather than overstate things. And what we've seen in the last 5 years in southern Greenland is this unexpected acceleration in the rate at which the ice is moving from the land into the ocean. And we believe this is related to this meltwater forming on the surface. And through moulons, this water makes its way down through the cracks and down to the base of these ice fields, and they're actually lubricating the bottom and allowing, reducing the friction and allowing the flow quicker. And, of course, we have similar things going on down in the Antarctic Peninsula with the ice shelves. The science community was amazed at how rapidly these ice shelves disintegrate. Once you get the formation of water and ponds on the surface, and then that water goes down through the cracks, and they break up much more rapidly than we would have predicted. And so, to me, it's these surprises that exist in our natural system that we don't fully understand that could catch us up short.
It's interesting. In a previous discussion with Mark Serres, this term surprises came up as well. I think perhaps that is the term right now that we have to be aware of, because I don't think we can predict all the changes. I think there's going to be a lot of surprises. I know I grew up, for example, in Minnesota, and there was a big difference between trying to walk on ice and trying to walk on ice with water.
Yes.
It was a radical difference.
Yes.
And so that's just to help the listener understand why it is that this water under the glaciers, between the glacier and the rock, is important, is because it just becomes a much slicker surface, and these glaciers then can move more easily over that surface, which, if that water weren't there, basically have a normal migration of the glaciers.
Which is much slower.
Which is much slower, that's correct.
Yeah. And I think these thresholds and surprises exist in so many parts of our system. You know, science is something that progresses, and we observe and we modify our models and as we get new data, and the system changes. And so to me, I think that there are all kind of evidence. If you're looking at the ice cores themselves, you're looking at the rates at which change occurred in the past, long before man was a big part of the system. They were very rapid, and they tell us that, you know, the system is capable, our climate system, of very rapid changes over short periods of time, and that forcing could be natural forcing, you know, due to changes in orbital parameters, or it could be due to changes in our atmospheric composition due to human activity in the modern world. I think the take-home message is that the system is capable of these very abrupt changes. And, of course, when we think about people and cultures and societies, these are the things we have the most difficulty adapting to.
This is the type of discussion that could go on for hours and days because it is so complex, and it will be, actually, this upcoming weekend at the Stegner Center. Just as a human being on this planet, what are your concerns that you think people should be aware of as a result of your research?
Well, my concern, and I realize most people, you know, when you think about the tropics, most people don't think about glaciers.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, it almost comes as a surprise. I don't think about glaciers in the tropics.
Right, but these bodies are very sensitive to, you know, the changes taking place, and I think the message is very clear that the system is changing, and my fear is it's changing much faster than we realize. And we have this thing, you know, it's called creeping normacy. And, you know, I've lived here in Ohio for 30 years. And when I first came here, we used to have blizzards and temperatures in the winter would get down to minus 22 to 25. We haven't had that for 15 years. But the fact is we now have thunderstorms in December and January and February. And, you know, because you're looking at the mean, the back part of the background changing gradually, we don't often realize how much that change has actually occurred. And you see it, again, in all kind of systems. If you're out in L.A., people who have lived there for 30 years and the city grew up around them don't see the traffic congestion and the problems that I see when I go to visit because this creeping normacy, what you consider norm and what you remember, you know, is more associated with what you've seen in the last 5 years rather than what you've seen in the last 50 years. And so I think that some of these changes, they're creeping up on us, and we don't realize them as much as we should.
I think this concept of surprises is one I'm going to start focusing on more. And I'd just be curious if you were to imagine some possible surprises that may come as a surprise. Obviously, the increasing frequency and magnitude of the hurricanes may or may not be part of this. But what other types of surprises do you think people should be really beginning to think about?
Well, I having been out and having spent 3 days with Charles Keeling earlier this year, in the event of the Tyler Prize in California, we had a long discussion about this whole issue of the rise in CO2 in our atmosphere, and you know we're at 380 parts per million by volume, and we now have records in the ice core, in the air bubbles, going back 650,000 years. And we know that the natural variability was between 180, 190 parts per million during ice ages when we had large ice sheets on the planet. It was very cold, getting up to 280 or 290 parts per million by volume during warm periods when the glaciers retreated to the north. And we're now at 380 parts per million by volume, increasing 2 parts per million each year. And so there's no analog in 650,000 years of that. But one of the things that, the planet is our friend. I mean, we're now releasing 8.5 billion metric tons of CO2 to the atmosphere every year. And the natural systems are sequestering over half of that. And so the question of whether these natural systems, the oceans, the terrestrial system, the plants, can become saturated, that they will no longer in our future take up CO2 at the same rate that they have done for us in the past. And to me, this is one of the surprises that may be out there.
Hmm.
I mean, we've drilled in the mountains of southeast Alaska, on Boner Churchill and the Wrangell St. Elias Mountains. And flying into there just a couple years ago, we flew over 4 million acres of dead spruce trees. Now, the spruce trees and trees are a natural sink for carbon. But because of the unusually warm winters up there, there have been an outbreak of this spruce bark beetle that have killed these trees. And they're just waiting for a match or lightning. And then suddenly what had been a sink for carbon becomes a source. And to me, these are potential surprises that exist in our future.
Climate change is like a great big huge ship. And once it's headed in a direction, it's hard to change that ship. We can't turn it around like we can with a speedboat.
And this is absolutely, when I look at human nature and how we behave, you know, humans are pretty good dealing with crisis situations. When your back's against the wall and you have no other choice and it's very clear what direction you go. And there are all kind of examples in our past how we have dealt effectively there. But when you talk about these greenhouse gases and CO2, which has a residence time in our atmosphere of over 100 years, that if we wait for the first crisis to take any action, we have built in a whole series of crises because of this lag time in the system. And so to me, in some ways, it's kind of different from the types of things we've dealt with in the past, which were local environmental issues or national environmental issues. This is a global issue. And so it gives me a pause for concern about our institutions, where we elect people for 2 years or 4 years, not having this longer time perspective of what's in our long-term best interest.
To be realistic, and this is the tough question, one that I'm beginning to think we need to think about. Maybe we can't really turn this around. I mean, maybe we have to really face that our future and our lifetime is going to continue on this path, and that there are changes that are inevitable. That is a possibility, at least, isn't it?
I believe that these changes are already underway, and that's why in my own research program, I am focusing more and more onto the impact on the people that live in these areas where I work. We have a new project over in the southwest Himalayas, and a place called Nanunami. It's a source area for the Ganges River. There's a town there, Barong. It's been there over 1,500 years. It was on the old north-south Silk Road across Tibet. But those people, 85% of their water comes from the glaciers that are disappearing. And so you say, okay, I truly believe that this change is underway. And so part of our future has to be in adaptation. How do we replace the natural role of the glaciers in monitoring and controlling water supplies in those areas to see that there's water to sustain life there as we go into the future?
To a large extent, it's going to have to be addressed on a relatively bioregional basis, that it's going to be very localized to some people because of that relationship. It's not something that the UN can fix. We're going to have to become responsive to these varying situations.
I think we're going to have to certainly approach this problem on many different levels. First of all, we need to get on the same page that we do have to do something about our emissions. Conservation, you know, reduction, sequestering. We need to get started in that area. We also need to get started along the lines of really bringing commercially available alternative energy sources online. I mean, we're going to have to do that anyway because we're running out of our natural fossil fuels. But we should be doing that as preventing the full scale of possibilities that may exist out there in our future climate. And, of course, we have to work on, in these different regions, regional plans for how do we adapt to those changes.
As you look at your future research, where are you going to be focusing?
I'm going to be focusing more and more on how do we reduce the impacts of the loss of these water resources in these various parts of the world to the people who live there. Because I think that, we talk about, there's this immediate issue of what happens downstream in the water sources coming from these glaciers. But, all of those glaciers and the loss of those are indicative of this larger scale changes, which are going to change our distribution of weather, where we get rain, droughts, and the like. And then, of course, those melting glaciers are all contributing to this global sea level rise. And, you know, if you just forget the big glaciers like Greenland, which could increase sea level by 6 or 7 meters should it disappear, melt, or Antarctica, which could add another 65 meters. Just talk about the mountain glaciers, where we know they're disappearing. And if you look at the projected temperature increases and the loss of those ice fields, you've got at least a half a meter sea level rise built into that. And you look globally and say, okay, you're going to displace, of the order of 100 million people. Hmm. And then you have to ask the question, where are they going to go? So the scale of these problems, I mean, they go from all the way from the high mountain regions and, to the tropics to our ability to produce food and have maintained water supplies to impacts of sea level rise. And then, as you already mentioned, how does that feed back into the size, number of storms, hurricanes, typhoons? All of which have tremendous economic, social impacts on humanity.
How do we affect? Oh, go ahead.
So to me, we really need to get started on making a difference. And frankly, there has been a lot of talk, but if you look at real progress on this issue, we're actually losing ground.
The question partly becomes, how do we take the science and bring it into the mainstream? You're very fortunate to be able to travel as you do around the world, and it sometimes feels as if perhaps there's many in the world who are aggressively addressing these issues, or certainly are very concerned about them, and sometimes it feels as if in the United States here we keep playing some sort of game with this truth. If you contrast the two, where do you see the power base for this awareness growing?
My personal opinion is that it's going to come from the bottom up. It's going to come from people realizing that this change is happening and we have to do something about it. I mean, I often wonder, what is this wake-up call going to look like? In 2003, in Europe, over a period of a couple of months, 49,000 people died from a heat wave there. That wasn't the wake-up call. This past 2 years of hurricane season and the impact of Katrina on New Orleans and the costs associated with that, still not a wake-up call. But the people who live in these areas, and the people who are impacted by them. They're taking notice. And eventually, our government will follow because they will have no choice. I mean, we are still a democracy, and you know, our political leaders are still elected. And I see more and more, just you know, in a couple, last couple of weeks, the evangelical church movement, you know, 86 different denominations, you know, being concerned about the stewardship of the earth and protecting our neighbors, which is part of the teachings there. And so I think there, I sense, and I've been working on glaciers now for 30 years, and when I get a chance, I try to show what's happening out there. And but I sense a growing concern at all different levels that business as usual is not going to work for us, and we will have to take some meaningful action here.
Maybe a day will come when we can quit fighting over issues that somehow are associated with terrorism and politics and start to unite to restore our Earth. I think that would be a grand battle.
I think it would be a grand battle, and I, frankly, my opinion, what we face due to these climate change issues are much greater than what we face due to terrorism.
That's our future. I believe I'm in perfect agreement. Dr. Lonnie Thompson with the Byrd Polar Research Center, I want to thank you for giving your expertise and your advice and your opinions and really expressing your humanity here on the Wild Side News.
I'm glad to have been able to do so.
Don't be surprised if we're in for some surprises. These climate issues are all interrelated, and playing a huge role in the future of life on Earth are the oceans, which recently have thrown some powerful warnings our way. Do we see them as the warming warnings they are? That's up to you. We continue our journey as we go in depth into the mysteries of the oceans and what they reveal about global warming when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.